become more aware of what's called intermittent encryption here, which they're doing is they don't encrypt your entire file. So if you have a file that's, let's say, a megabyte in size, it'll go through and maybe even do little blocks as small as 16 bytes and just grab little 16 bytes out of encrypted. So your software, like your antivirus or anti-malware software, doesn't even detect it. But when you go to open that file, it's just encrypted enough that you can't open it and read it anymore. So it becomes very difficult to detect in production environments. And you may not even notice it until it's way too late because they've already encrypted just enough of your data that you can't read any of it.
Welcome back to another episode of Data Protection Gumbo, and today's episode dives into data protection strategies. And so we are joined by Jerome Wind, and Jerome is the CEO and principal analyst at DCIG. He's also a respected voice in data protection. And so, Jerome, welcome to the Gumbo. How's your new year so far?
Well, Demetrius, thanks for having me. Good to be joining you again, and New Year's off to a great start.
All right, so let's set the stage here. So hybrid and multi-cloud infrastructures are transforming IT virtualization, are transforming IT.
Right.
And so virtualization and also AI, artificial intelligence driven solutions are reshaping some of the strategies that are out there right now. We're hearing a lot about AI, AGI, and the list goes on, right?
Yes.
And backup solutions obviously have to evolve in order to meet these modern needs, and everyone's rolling out co-pilots and agents and saying that they have a new AI system and they're giving it fancy names, et cetera, right?
Right.
And then there was something else that happened several months ago. It was back in 2024. There was an industry shift where VMware was acquired by Broadcom, right? Yeah. I think that was about, $69, $70 billion deal? Yeah. And maybe this was a couple of years now, right?
It was actually December 2023. It's actually been over a year already since that deal was finalized. Wow. So, yeah, that was probably one of the biggest shifts in virtualization that we saw.
Yeah, and then there was a lot of headache around subscription-based licensing and perpetual licenses. I mean, there was a lot of stink about customers being charged and there were higher costs, and it was a lot, right? So yeah. We won't dive into it, but just wanted to bring that up to lay the playing field of what we're dealing with here. So we'll discuss some of the changing priorities and backup solutions and backups and how new emerging technologies are changing that. Let's start with a big question. Is VMware vSphere backup, is that still relevant today?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I would say it's absolutely still relevant, but I would say the priorities of how organizations should look at their VMware backup solutions has changed.
Okay.
One of the things that we're actually getting ready to release a number of reports on VMware backup solutions.
Mm-hmm.
And in doing this research, which we really focused on the last, I'd say the last 3 or 4 months of 2024, going into 2025, has to do with, we didn't really see necessarily a lot of changes in how companies are backing up VMware backup, but we saw sort of a shifting in priority. Some of the new features is like, as they look to back up VMware, where can they restore? They're looking almost to use data protection tools now as a migration tool to move off of VMware. So how do they back up VMware and how do they restore it into other hypervisors? Because they, for some of the reasons you cited, the companies can no longer, those who had perpetual licenses with VMware, those are not available anymore. Now, they might have existing licenses with VMware where they can, where they still have perpetual licenses, but many companies are basically being forced into this subscription-based model, and they're also facing higher prices along with it. And they're just like, yeah, for the features we use in VMware, we can't justify making that sort of investment in VMware anymore. Now, are they going to completely abandon VMware? I seriously doubt that. But are they going to be, you know, is that going to be their, are they still going to be a one-stop shop from, you know, a VMware shop where that's all they're using internally? My guess is we're going to go from a single hypervisor environment to more organizations, more enterprises with multi-hypervisor environments. So as they make that transition, they need tools, often backup software is facilitating their migration off of VMware into other hypervisors. So one of the features that they're looking at more critically in these backup solutions is how well do they restore to hypervisors? How well do they restore to Hyper-V? How well do they restore to any KVM-based hypervisor that they can do those, you know, facilitate those migrations? And, you know, then even, and then so that's really sort of the big shift that I'm seeing as far as an emphasis is how well those tools work, how well do they restore to other platforms.
Okay.
Can they recover back? I mean, that's sort of a big point of emphasis as we're going into 2025 in these solutions.
And have you seen Proxmox?
Yeah, so, you know, I get asked a lot about Proxmox, and I hear that question come up a lot. There's initially a lot of interest in it. It's like, oh man, you know, it's getting a lot of buzz. But when companies actually start peeling back the covers, it's, you know, it's really not enterprise ready. It's just not.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that, and I would say if you're looking for a one-to-one, and we actually did a report on VMware vSphere alternatives last year in 2024 as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And when you look at viable VMware vSphere alternatives, when you really start getting into some of the really enterprise features that some enterprises use that VMware vSphere offers, you're going to be hard pressed to find that with anyone right now. I mean, out there, Nutanix, Hyper-V, Citrix, you know, they're just, I mean, and that really gets into like how they can manage external storage arrays, how they can, you know, do things like VMware vSphere volumes, how they can do their VMware APIs for array integration that are VMware APIs for data protection. I mean, there's all these really intricate APIs that VMware offers that if enterprises are using it, boy, they're going to be, they are not going to find comparable solutions right now in other products. But as you go down this path and look for, but you know, having said that, these other products, I mean, I've probably seen more development in other hypervisors in the last 12 months than I've seen in the last 12 years. As far as them bringing, because there's such a demand for those services now, because companies are actually looking for viable VMware alternatives, where before that demand just wasn't there. So that's, I mean, if you talk to me a year from now, you know, this, my comments on that same subject may change quite a bit.
Okay, got it. And you mentioned earlier that I guess some of these backup solutions are being used as migration tools, right, to migrate off of, let's say, the number one player, VMware, right?
Yeah.
I think VMware is still the number one player as far as hypervisors are concerned, right?
Yeah. As far as like an enterprise, they're far and away. I mean, I hate to say that. I mean, I've heard numbers as high as 80% of market share. I mean, you know, at least in enterprises. I mean, it may even be higher than that. They have a huge presence.
Yeah, and also as far as cybersecurity, so keeping things secure, obviously ransomware is still a topic that's top of mind. And now you talk about geopolitical issues and challenges right around U.S. telecom companies being hacked, and it's a whole thing, right? I don't know if you're following. Are you following any of that?
Yeah, like, I follow the developments more specifically around how different backup providers, backup targets are incorporating, you know, ransomware detection. I would say it's even evolving now to anomaly detection is how that's evolving.
Yeah.
It's what I am seeing and how these providers are addressing it. So I follow that. I mean, like every single attack, you know, I could probably sit here all day and just read about every single attack and every single incident. And I don't have that sort of bandwidth to do that, but.
Right.
I follow at a high level. Yes.
And so you mentioned that you're working on some reports. Is there any report in particular that you can share, maybe that you're working on, just so we can kind of know what emerging technologies are out there from DCIG and anything with containers? Do you work on that?
Yeah, I haven't done any recent work on containers. It's you know, what I've seen is since it seems like everything is centered around VMware right now.
Mm-hmm.
But since companies are, there's even one company where I live here that I know that's heavily, you know, gone down heavily down the container Kubernetes path and want to move more to a cloud-based platform. Even they've had to kind of put a lot of that development on hold as they kind of address how they're going to address, you know, well, their VMware VMs, the amount of budget they would have to allocate to VMware to continue the license would be like this giant sucking sound out of all their other budgets for everything else. So they're looking at first getting off of VMware, finding some other comparable platforms then. And again, these are really complicated questions that organizations and, you know, enterprises specifically, as they look at containers. Okay, like I mentioned, like companies are using backup software to migrate to other hypervisors. They're also looking at them to migrate to Kubernetes, or, you know, can they restore into a Kubernetes or containers type environment and take their applications? I mean, these are all the sort of questions and evaluations they're making. Or if they can do that, how quickly can they migrate or replatform from their existing VMware environment into a Kubernetes containers type environment? Or can they even do that? Can they realistically do that in a time frame? In a time frame that meets their internal budgeting needs? It's and again, there's no easy answer to any of these questions. I mean, it's yeah. Certain, there's a different answer for each one, or for each organization, different answer.
Okay. And let's talk a little bit about priorities in modern backup solutions. And so organizations have very clear priorities for backup today. And number one is making sure that backup is secure, it's protected, it's air gapped, it's immutable, and making sure that bad actors and, you know, ransomware can't actually take the backup and render it like unrecoverable, right? That's top of mind today. But we can't forget some of the features around like speed and scalability and also ease, right? We want to see all types of recovery technology to be easier, right? Because when you're under pressure to recover, you don't want to need a PhD in order to try to get a file back or get a whole file system back or restore an entire, you know, container or a virtual image. But are there any demands or new demands that you see reshaping some of these priorities just from where you sit and the research that you're doing?
Yeah, so really on that front, you know, it's a good question around what companies are. You know, I would say the whole concept around, you know, backup being difficult to accomplish, I say companies have largely solved the backup problem. And since, you know, they've used disk as backup, or even using flash as backup, snapshots have, you know, become, or even continuous data protection is now, you know, becoming more common. Like, and this could be, you know, either, you know, there's, you know, a couple of different ways they implement it, whether it's, you know, like, you know, maybe once an hour snapshots, or, you know, where they copy all rights. I mean, I'm seeing, you know, sort of all iterations of it being implemented. So, you know, and I think the more that companies want to do these faster recoveries, you know, the more it becomes imperative that they do, you know, implement those sort of technologies, whether it's continuous data protection or some iteration of it to get to facilitate these fast recoveries. The other thing I'm seeing more often too is like, we did some reports this last year on a lot of cyber secure backup targets, to your point, where companies are actually using the backup targets, you know, for some reason their production storage becomes compromised, or they can't quickly recover. They can start the recovery actually on their backup target. And then, you know, start the recovery there and then begin to, you know, just seamlessly, you know, as their application actually runs now on the backup target, they can seamlessly move that over into production and kind of keep running, you know, either with minimal or no disruption in order to do that recovery. So those are some of the, you know, some of the nuances, some of the ways that companies are leveraging faster recoveries, that there is really no time for downtime anymore, even for the, you know, even what people want to consider, you know, maybe mission critical, business critical, and then just normal applications. I would say pretty much the expectation now that we can recover all these applications in, you know, seconds, if not minutes already, no matter what their status is. Now, again, that's not universally true, but I would say any application that takes more than an hour to recover, even normal app, you know, quote unquote, normal applications. I would say that's even becoming less acceptable for organizations. There's now an expectation you're going to cover under an hour, and in light of that, there's been some significant advances in those areas to help facilitate that.
Okay. And I know we brushed on the topic of AI and anomaly detection a little earlier as well, but we know AI and storage also, especially cloud, is a really hot topic also, that companies are still moving more and more workloads into the cloud. Yeah. And I really want to pick your brain here to understand, where do you see AI sitting just from a backup and recovery technology perspective? And one day I completely see AI and self-aware data so that, let's say you have an application, that application would understand the most critical components to it in order to continue running.
Right.
And also the most important aspects that whoever the users are would need that's important for them as far as operationally from a business perspective, and that it would have the intelligence and capability to protect that, secure it, store it off in whatever method, if it needs to air gap it or it needs to make it immutable or it needs to make a snapshot or it needs to store it here or there, then it will do all of those things without someone clicking a button. And then if you need a recovery, it'll do that as well, because it knows that, you know what, someone came in and someone deleted this file. So let me just go ahead and recover it over here and let you know that, hey, this happened and we recovered the file here. Do you see backups getting that advanced, or where do you see it headed?
Yeah. So to your point, there's actually a backup application out there that already does that.
Okay.
It actually detects it. Now, again, it's more application specific. I saw that one specifically with and for Microsoft 365 backups, where it can actually, proactively identifies ransomware, sees the files that it's affected, quarantines the files, and actually recovers it before anyone even notices. So that technology already exists, and it's been out there for maybe a year or two. Okay, so there are companies out there that are doing it for, you know, sort of application specific. Whole scale, like, you know, for, you know, your entire enterprise under that sort of level of protection, I'm seeing signs of that pretty much everywhere. That I think that's the vision, is where as many companies are going, as you look more broadly across your enterprise, that companies are going to want that intelligent detection of ransomware and want to recover it. Now, it's sort of the trick there is why I'm, you know, I would say even in the last year, I've heard sort of I've noticed a shift in how even providers are phrasing it. It's not really ransomware detection anymore. It's anomaly detection. That probably started in 2024, sort of in force, where they started, not that they're not using the term ransomware, but that's not what they say the product does anymore. They talk more about anomaly detection, because the strains of ransomware are evolving, you know, almost by the minute sometimes, and what they're trying to detect on these enterprises. And frankly, hackers are using AI to develop ransomware. So there's all sorts of, like, all these moves and counter moves going on in the cyber world now, and it's happening almost by the minute as far as how quickly these organizations need to recover. So organizations that say, okay, here's a signature that's this specific strain of ransomware, that just doesn't work in today's world, at least for enterprises that are routinely being attacked. They're not looking for anomalies. And I think even a misconception I had coming into this year was that ransomware, you know, one of the attacks that tries to delete everything, or maybe exfiltrate, what might I say, you know, maybe deletes all the data, encrypts all the data, or exfiltrates or copies all the data off premises. Now I say, you know, that's all still true, but I think, you know, I've become more aware of what's called intermittent encryption here, which they're doing is they don't encrypt your entire file. So if you have a file that's, you know, let's say, you know, a megabyte in size, it'll go through and maybe even do little blocks as small as 16 bytes and just grab little 16 bytes out of encrypted. So your software, like your antivirus or anti-malware software, doesn't even detect it. But when you go to open that file, it's just encrypted enough of it that you can't open it and read it anymore. So it becomes, that becomes very difficult to detect in production environments. And you may not even notice it until it's way too late, because they've already encrypted just enough of your data that you can't read any of it. So it's
yeah, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, it's, and yet it's becoming very prevalent, because that's how quickly, I've got a report that's coming out here in a couple of weeks on that exact topic, a little bit on how ransomware is so rapidly evolving. So what strain of ransomware does it? Well, a lot of them are doing it. How do you stop just one strain? It sort of becomes anomaly detection. So how quickly can you detect it in real time, so you can begin to make those course corrections or identify or isolate that specific application or client or whatever it is that has that software or that malware that's running on it. It's really become, you know, really a high stakes game here on both sides, both on, you know, for the hacker side and on the enterprise side, to identify these, you know, these different strains of ransomware that are finding their way into the environment. and react quickly. I mean, to your point, like companies, I mean, when this happens, you need to recover quickly. So it's not just recovering, but finding a good recovery point. So if it's been, like if you're doing this intermittent encryption, well, you have to figure out when did that first start? Because, you know, if it's just doing little, 16 byte chunks of files, this could be going on for some time. So do you have to go back 10 minutes, 10 hours, 10 days to find enough good files to where you're not reintroducing the ransomware back into your
environment? Is that encrypting the backup file or the production?
No, there's production data as well. But if you're getting production data that is being encrypted and then you're doing backups of that encrypted data, then you still have to find kind of when it got introduced so you can find a backup that precedes the point of encryption, if that makes sense. So you're not recovering the files that already have encrypted data on it. So the real challenge now for organizations try to catch that in real time as quickly as possible so they can do those recoveries.
Yeah, and it seems like there would be some type of SIM, SOAR, XDR, something that can catch the incoming data. And as far as the encryption happening, no matter how small it is, that this is something that's not normal.
Yeah, right. And that does exist, but not every antiviral, not everyone will catch every instance of that. So, I mean, yes, I'm definitely finding instances of backup software that are doing it. But I think, anyone who's listening to this webinar, these are questions that they need to be asking their providers. And again, I'm not like this advocating, well, immediately dump your provider and go to the other one. I think the more question is how quickly can your existing backup software provider account for these, these changes? Because, I mean, you could be switching backup providers every 3 months, so you catch the latest strain of ransomware. I don't think that's prudent or realistic for most organizations either.
Yeah, I do see backup solution in vendors. They are scanning the backups.
Absolutely. Yep.
They're looking at the data for anomalies. And so, of course, I guess if it's encrypted before as a first backup, is that an anomaly? Because it's...
Yeah, well, right. Because they may not even catch it. Because they have nothing to compare it against. So it's right. Like, again, the first backup, everyone sort of assumes that's a quote-unquote good backup. Again, that's where I think it's kind of important to... I know some backup providers, they offer sort of they call it, it's called post-process anomaly or, ransomware scanning. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of what you have to do. But again, to your point, what constitutes an anomaly? If you're only looking for files that are encrypted at, 1 megabyte sizes and you're being encrypted at 16 bits, you may never even catch those little anomalies because it's not looking for the right thing.
Final question here for you, Jerome. Where do you see there's a lot happening in the job market today? So, right. Post-pandemic, right? A lot of layoffs. Companies are right-sizing, realizing that they hired too much. AI is also a thing. And there's a lot just happening psychologically and mentally across the world when it pertains to jobs. And I've even read about a white-collar recession where IT jobs, technology jobs, attorneys, lawyers, but healthcare is booming, which probably will continue to be a booming industry.
Yes.
Where do you see hiring from a perspective of, let's say, the storage, backup, recovery, cybersecurity industry? What advice do you have for someone that's out there right now that may be laid off or maybe even looking to transition into another position?
Right.
What would you be doing if you were in that situation?
Individuals who are over 50 are really struggling to find jobs right now. Mm-hmm. Really struggling. I've got a good friend of mine who can't find a job. He turned 50 a year or two ago. Can't find a job. So,
Has it been longer than 6 months? Because I'm reading that's the average 6 months to 9 months and 500 plus applications.
Yeah. That doesn't surprise me. And even then, I find more going down the contracting path. I've been sort of on my own now for, going on, be 20 years here in a year or two. So
yeah. Congrats.
Thank you. So I've been, this will be my, 19 years or whatever, being out as DCIG or 18, something like that. So, I think it's like, if you go down that path, I think there's an opportunity there because sometimes they can't afford all your expertise. So again, I'm talking to like someone who's had maybe 20, 25 years of experience. I'm reading articles like that. They're having harder times finding jobs.
Mm-hmm.
That I think there's a, you know, there's a realistic path forward for you to set up yourself as an independent, because you do have good knowledge. You know, it's not that hard to set up a website, not that hard. I mean, you know, you've done it, I've done it. I mean, don't get me wrong, there's work involved with it, but I found it actually more rewarding, and it creates sort of a stable path forward. And you can kind of go indefinitely. I'm very acquainted with, you know, I have sons who are in their 20s, okay? So they're actively engaged in the job market. In the Midwest here, it's been less of an issue finding jobs, at least in our area, and at least in the, you know, their 20s and 30s. But you know, the cybersecurity, the data infrastructure, even databases, those always seem to be always in demand. And then, you know, any cloud skills. In fact, I think here, even, you know, living here in Omaha, I even think like some of the cloud providers are actually paying for classes at the, you know, community colleges for you to learn how to do data center management. And then they'll hire you as soon as you graduate from it. So there are those sort of opportunities available where you're learning, you know, different cloud skills where they'll actually put you through it. And again, I haven't looked to investigate those in depth, but it, you know, those opportunities are out there. We don't even need a college degree. They're looking more for specific cloud management skills that, you know, they can immediately put you to work in their environment.
Well, great advice, and really appreciate you being on Data Protection Gumbo. And this was a insightful discussion, and also thank you for sharing your expertise with us today, Jerome. Before I let you go, I do want to let everyone know about the YouTube channel that we do have. We are trying to ramp up on subscribers because we started the game late. So please check us out on YouTube as Data Protection Gumbo. And on LinkedIn, go check out the Backup and Recovery Professionals LinkedIn group, which has over, I think it's about 26,000 professionals in that group now, because communities are very much needed today in this day and age where job hunting and networking is also something very key and critical for those that are older, such as ourselves here, Jerome, as well.
Absolutely.
But I appreciate you. Any thing that you would like to shout out from a DCIG perspective that you're working on, or anything else that you'd like to leave the audience with?
Yeah, well, again, Demetrius, just want to again thank you for having me on. You know, I enjoy our discussions here. On the DCIG side, just sort of keep an eye on our website. We are, you know, we have a newsletter you can sign up to. You know, if you go to our website, there's a place you can sign up for. At least gives, you know, alerts you to our latest top five reports. Again, we're doing some on VMware backup. We're actually doing our first set of we have our first set of reports coming out on S3 alternatives to Amazon S3, like other backup or other cloud object storage that you can use. I mean, there's actually, we found over 50 different providers for cloud object out there. So it is a booming market right now, and there's a lot of alternatives out there. So we're going to be exploring that. And then, as always, we're also looking for, we're going to be looking at doing backup solutions for Microsoft 365, AWS, Google, Azure. That'll all be coming out in 2025. At least that's all on our calendar right now.
So, okay.
A lot of good things happening.
Yeah. I'm definitely looking forward to it, Jerome. Thank you again for being a guest on the show here.
My pleasure. Thank you again, Demetrius.